All right, imagine this. You're scrolling through the news, right? And boom, there's this huge breaking news alert. And it's accusing like a super well-known company, maybe even one in your field of study, of doing something really shady, like really unethical.
Oh, wow.
You know, the kind of stuff that makes you go, whoa, wait, what? You know, what would happen?
I mean, talk about an immediate impact, right?
Huge, right.
Yeah. The reputation would just be like shattered.
Gone, yeah.
And then, you know, lawsuits probably flying left and right.
Oh, yeah.
It really makes you think about those legal lines, you know?
Whoa.
Where's the line when you're making these accusations so publicly?
Yeah, for sure. And that whole scenario, that's exactly what we're going to unpack in this deep dive today. We're looking at a case, Brown Williamson, Tobacco Corp. V. Jacobson.
Oh, yeah. This case, this is huge. I mean, it's not just some old case study.
Yeah. You know, it's a landmark case.
It's a landmark decision.
It is.
It really gets to the heart of corporate defamation, media accountability. And, of course, you can't forget libel law. All super important stuff for, you know, any aspiring legal eagle out there.
Right. Essential stuff. Okay, so before we jump in, let's set the stage. Who are the players in this legal drama?
Okay, so we have Brown and Williamson, and they are the makers of Viceroy cigarettes.
Okay.
And they're facing off against, well, CBS and their news commentator, Walter Jacobson.
Right. And the big event, the thing that really sparked this whole legal battle.
A broadcast. Back in 1981, all about, you guessed it, cigarette advertising practices.
All right. So today we're going to dissect this whole thing. We're going to break down the legal principles, see how the court tackled the situation, and, you know, figure out why this case is still so important today when we're thinking about a company's reputation and the whole freedom of speech thing.
Absolutely.
Okay. So let's start at the beginning. Take us back, way back to 1975. There's this thing called the Kennan Plan that keeps popping up. What was that all about?
Wait, so picture this. 1975, bell bottoms, disco music, and in the world of advertising, a pretty bold strategy emerges called the Kennan Plan.
All right.
So an ad agency goes to Brown and Williamson, and they pitch this, let's just say, interesting idea. They want to connect smoking with, you know, illicit pleasures.
Ooh, illicit pleasures. Okay, give us some examples.
Think like drinking, sex, you know, things that would definitely raise eyebrows.
Right.
Especially since they were aiming to attract a younger audience, you know, get them to start smoking Viceroy cigarettes.
Wow, that's pretty direct. So what did Brown and Williamson think about that? Did they jump on board?
You know, you might think they'd be all for it, but they weren't.
Really?
No, not at all. They actually completely rejected the Kennan Plan.
They said, no way.
No way. Not only that, they actually fired the ad agency that came up with it.
Oh, wow. Serious rejection.
Yeah.
That's a big deal.
And this is important, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Because this rejection is going to come back later.
Okay, so we're setting the stage here.
We are.
All right, so fast forward a few years. It's now 1981. The Kennan Plans, like a distant memory, right?
Yeah.
What happens to bring it back into the spotlight?
Okay, so the FTC, the Federal Trade Commission, they release a report about, you know, cigarette advertising. And guess what? They mentioned the Kennan Plan.
Okay.
And that's where Walter Jacobson comes in.
Okay. And he's the news commentator from CBS.
He is.
All right.
And he sees this FTC report, picks up on the Kennan Plan, and starts talking about it on air.
Okay. So he's reporting on this FTC report, discussing this old plan. What's the problem?
It's the way he presented it. You know, it's not just straight reporting.
Okay. How so?
He accuses cigarette companies of being dishonest, straight up lying about not targeting kids in their ads.
Ooh, that's a bold claim.
It is. But it gets even more interesting when he specifically talks about Brown and Williamson.
Mm-hmm.
He strongly implies that they're still using the Kennan Plan.
Wait, hold on. But they rejected it.
Exactly.
And they fired the ad agency. This was years ago.
Years ago, yeah. That's the problem.
So Jacobson's basically saying they're doing something they already publicly said they wouldn't do.
Right. And that's why Brown and Williamson decides to sue.
They say, hey, this isn't right.
Yeah, they felt like their reputation was being unfairly tarnished.
Right, and they're claiming libel, right?
Exactly.
So what happens when this case goes to court?
Okay, so Brown and Williamson, they take CBS and Jacobson to federal court.
Okay.
And initially, the district court actually sides with CBS and Jacobson.
Oh, really? They dismiss the case?
They dismiss it, yeah.
Uh-huh.
They felt that freedom of the press was super important.
Yeah.
You know? They didn't want to create a situation where, Journalists were afraid to report on things, especially critical things, because they were worried about being sued for libel.
Right. So the initial thought was, we need to protect the media's right to report freely.
Exactly.
But that wasn't the end of the story, was it?
Oh, no. Not even close.
Okay.
Brown and Williamson, they're not giving up. They appeal this dismissal.
They're like, wait a minute.
Yeah. They go to the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Seventh Circuit, and guess what?
What?
They overturn the lower court's decision.
Oh, wow. A reversal.
Yeah.
So they say, hold on, there's enough here to keep going. This defamation claim deserves a closer look.
Exactly.
So what were some of the key legal ideas that the Seventh Circuit focused on? Why did they decide to allow the case to proceed?
Well, there's this concept called libel per se.
Libel per se, okay.
It's specific to Illinois law. And it basically means that some statements are so inherently damaging to a person's reputation, to a company's reputation, that they're considered defamatory right off the bat. You know, like the harm is just assumed.
So it's so obviously harmful that the law is like, yep, that's libel.
Right. And the person who's claiming they've been libeled, they don't even have to prove they lost money or anything.
The damage is just like a given.
Exactly. Yes. It's just so blatant.
Okay. So how did the court decide that what Jacobson said could be libel per se?
Well, think about it. He accused Brown and Williamson of this really unethical strategy, like a plan to use tricky advertising to get kids hooked on smoking.
Right, using those illicit pleasures we talked about.
Exactly. That's not just some minor accusation. That goes straight to the heart of a company's image, you know?
Yeah, like their integrity, their morals, their responsibility.
Exactly. And for a tobacco company especially, that's everything. That could seriously hurt their business, make people not want to buy their products.
Right. It's like saying, hey, this company doesn't care about kids. They just want to make money.
Exactly. And under this libel per se idea, Brown and Williamson wouldn't even have to show that they lost specific customers or sales because of the broadcast.
That's interesting. So the court was basically saying the damage is so clear cut, you don't even have to prove it with numbers.
Precisely.
Okay, now there's another piece to this puzzle, right? Something called the fair summary privilege. What is that all about?
Okay, so imagine you're a journalist, right? And you're reporting on some official government document. Like, say, a report from the FTC, just like in this case.
Okay.
The fair summary privilege basically protects you. It says you can report on this stuff without being sued for libel, as long as your reporting is accurate and fair.
Yeah.
You know? A true reflection of what's in the document.
That makes sense. You should be able to tell the public what's going on in the government without fear of getting in trouble.
Right, exactly.
Okay, so Jacobson was reporting on this official FTC report, right? Why didn't this privilege shield him from the lawsuit? It seems like he should have been protected, right?
That's the million-dollar question, isn't it?
Yeah.
And this is where things get really fascinating. This is where the greater sting comes in.
Greater sting? Okay, that sounds intriguing.
It is.
Lay it on me.
The court basically said, look, even though Jacobson was technically talking about the FTC report, he went way beyond just summarizing it.
Oh, okay.
He added his own spin, his own interpretation, and that's where the trouble started.
So he took those facts and then added something extra, something more damaging.
Exactly.
Okay, can you break that down for us? What exactly was the greater sting in Jacobson's broadcast? I feel like this is a really important point for people to understand.
Absolutely. It is. Let me give you an analogy. Imagine the FTC report says something like, hey, back in 75, Brown and Williamson thought about using this questionable advertising tactic, but they ultimately decided against it.
Right.
Straightforward, factual.
Okay, got it.
Now, what Jacobson does is he takes that and twists it.
Twists it how?
He makes it sound like Brown and Williamson is still actively using this unethical strategy to target kids right now in 1981.
Oh, I see. He's implying something that's not actually in the report.
Exactly. He's creating this impression of current wrongdoing, even though the plan was rejected years ago.
Yeah.
And that's the greater sting.
That's a huge difference. So by adding that extra layer of implication, he basically lost the protection that the fair summary privilege would have given him.
Exactly. The court said, you went too far. You didn't just report the facts. You created a new, more harmful narrative, and that's not okay.
Wow. That's a really fine line, isn't it?
It is. It shows that even if you're reporting on something official, you have to be so careful not to twist the information in a way that makes it defamatory.
Right. So this case is really important for us future lawyers because it shows that there are limits to this fair summary privilege.
Absolutely.
Okay, now I have another question. This might seem a bit basic, but it's something that's been on my mind. Can a corporation, like, actually be defamed in the same way a person can?
That's a great question.
I mean, a company isn't a person, right? It doesn't have feelings that can be hurt.
Right. A corporation doesn't experience emotions in the same way an individual does.
Mm-hmm.
But here's the thing. A corporation absolutely has a reputation.
Right, but it's not like personal feeling.
No, but it's just as vital. A corporation's reputation is tied to its business, its success. If people think a company is unethical or untrustworthy, they're less likely to do business with them.
So their reputation is directly linked to their bottom line, to how much money they make.
Exactly. And Judge Posner, who is on the court for this case, he summed it up perfectly. He said, a corporation can have a reputation for adhering to the moral standards of the community.
That's a good quote.
Yeah.
So it's about how a company acts, whether it behaves ethically, whether it's seen as a responsible member of society.
Exactly.
And how does that connect back to what Jacobson said about Brown and Williamson?
Well, think about the accusation. It wasn't just about some old plan they rejected. It was about them targeting kids with their advertising, which is something society sees as morally wrong.
Right. It's unethical. It goes against those moral standards that Judge Posner was talking about.
Exactly. And if people believe that, it could really damage Brandon Williamson's reputation. And like we said, a damaged reputation can hurt their business, their profits. So even though a corporation might not have feelings in the same way a person does, it can still be defamed. And the consequences can be very real.
That makes sense. Now, I want to touch on another legal concept that comes up a lot in defamation cases, public figure status. Can you explain what that means and how it relates to this case?
Sure. The idea of a public figure is important because it changes the rules a little bit when it comes to proving defamation.
How so?
Well, if you're considered a public figure, like a celebrity or a politician, it's harder to win a defamation lawsuit.
Yeah.
You have to prove something called actual malice.
Actual malice. Okay. What does that mean?
It means you have to prove that the person who said the defamatory thing knew it was false, or that they acted with reckless disregard for the truth, meaning they didn't really care whether it was true or not.
So it's not just about making a mistake. It's about intentionally spreading false information or being incredibly careless with the truth.
Exactly.
So was Brown Williamson considered a public figure in this case?
That's actually a tricky question. The court did make a clear ruling on that one way or another.
Okay, so they kind of left that hanging.
They did. But here's the interesting part. They said that even if Brown and Williamson were considered a public figure, their complaint still had enough evidence to suggest actual malice on Jacobson's part.
Oh, really? So they were saying there's a chance Jacobson knew he was being misleading, even if Brown and Williamson was held to that higher standard.
Exactly. And because of that, they let the case move forward.
Wow. So this actual malice idea was a big deal in the case, even though they didn't definitively say whether Brown and Williamson was a public figure or not.
It was. It raises some really interesting questions about the responsibility of journalists and the media, especially when they're reporting on things that could seriously impact a company's reputation.
For sure. Okay, so let's step back and think about everything we've covered. What are the big takeaways from this case? What should we, as future legal professionals, remember about Brown and Williamson v. Jacobson?
Well, first and foremost, this case shows that corporations can definitely be defamed.
It's not just about individuals being hurt. It's about protecting companies, too.
Right. And they don't always have to prove they lost money, especially if the accusations are so damaging that they fall under that libel per se category.
Right, where the harm is just assumed because the accusations are so bad.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Second, it highlights that even though the media has some protection when reporting on official stuff, that protection isn't unlimited. If they twist the information and make it more harmful, they can lose that protection.
Right, that greater sting idea, going beyond just summarizing and adding their own damaging spin.
Exactly.
Okay, and beyond those specific legal points, what are some of the broader themes or implications of this case? You know, what does it tell us about the legal system and the relationship between freedom of the press and protecting reputations?
That's a great question. I think this case really highlights the ongoing tension between two really important values. Freedom of the press, which is essential for a democracy, and the need to protect individuals and companies from unfair attacks on their reputations.
It's like trying to find that balance.
Exactly. We want a robust and free press, but we also need to make sure that freedom isn't used to spread false or harmful information.
And that balance applies to companies as well, not just individuals.
Absolutely. And this case is a great example of how the courts try to navigate that tension to figure out where the lines are drawn.
It definitely makes you think. So as we wrap up, I want to leave our listeners with a final thought to ponder, especially as they continue their legal education. We've been talking about a case from 1981, right?
Oh, right.
But think about how much the media landscape has changed since then.
Oh, absolutely. It's a completely different world.
We have social media, online news outlets, blogs, all sorts of ways for information to spread quickly and widely.
It's incredible how much it's evolved.
So my question is, how do you think the principles from Brown and Williamson v. Jacobson apply in today's world? You know, how do we balance freedom of speech with protecting reputations in this constantly changing digital age? What responsibilities do we all have as individuals and as legal professionals to ensure that information is accurate and fair, especially when it comes to the reputations of companies and organizations? It's a big question with no easy answers, but it's something worth thinking about as we navigate this new media landscape.
It is. It's a question that will continue to challenge us for years to come.
This has been a fascinating discussion. Thank you so much for joining me on this deep dive into Brown and Williamson v. Jacobson.
My pleasure. It's always great to unpack these important legal issues.
I agree. And to our listeners, thank you for tuning in. We'll see you next time for another deep dive into the world of law.
Until then.